Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Okay, it's Thursday, 1 o'clock, and once again, you have tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to The Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. We're coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn on a lovely 70-degree sunny day. And today we are on the line with Sandor Katz to talk about his new book, The Art of Fermentation. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Erin. It's great to be with you today.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So your book, The Art of Fermentation, is an in-depth exploration of the essential concepts and processes regarding fermentation from around the world. And I know, you know, when we're talking fermentation, there's a lot of stuff that comes to mind. And just to name a few that are covered in the book, you talk about beer, wine, cider, olives, cheese, pickles, yogurt, bread, kombucha, coffee, chocolate, miso, soy sauce, tofu, tempeh, fish sauce. I mean, I could go on. And I'd say it's probably comes as no surprise to anyone, if you'll excuse the pun, that fermentation is a pretty a hot topic, and a topic that you know, we engage with a lot in our daily lives through our diet, whether or not we kind of recognize that. But one of the things I thought was so interesting about your book is you kind of take this discussion, to my knowledge, kind of a step further. And I really want to explore with you today some of the stuff from the later chapters in your book, in particular your work and the explanation in the book around fermentation in agriculture, which was a surprising topic, I'll have to say. I mean, how did you decide to include that in your kind of compendium of fermentation work?
Well, you know, through the years, as I, you know, became interested in fermentation and, you know, first began practicing fermentation and then started exploring lots of different realms of fermentation, you know, at the same time as I've been doing that, I've been, you know, composting, keeping a garden, meeting other gardeners and farmers, hearing about silage, and I just realizing that, you know, in the same way that there's a certain inevitability to fermentation on food, and that, you know, cultures around the world you know, by necessity had to figure out ways of you know, working with that natural force, you know, the same is true of agriculture, where, you know, really, you know, the basis of soil fertility is the microbial breakdown of dead plant and animal matter. And, you know, some people put a lot of thought and planning into how they construct their compost piles. Some people do it in more you know, lackadaisical ways, but you know, whatever method you use, microorganisms are what break down dead plant and animal matter you know, into humus, which is the basis of the renewal of soil fertility. So I think that you know, fermentation is absolutely essential to agriculture, and even the bigger picture than agriculture, if we're thinking about, you know, the cycles of life and death, it's really the cycles of life and death and fermentation.
Awesome. Do you feel like you see fermentation everywhere?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Fermentation is everywhere.
And what is your kind of like working definition? I mean, as this kind of activity that impacts so many different aspects of food and of life. I mean, how in a few sentences, when someone asks you what exactly is fermentation, I mean, what's your answer to that?
Well, and this is usually how I you know, start off my talks and workshops, is just, you know, what is fermentation anyway? Broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. Biologists typically work with a more restrictive definition, that fermentation is anaerobic metabolism, the production of energy without oxygen. And most of the classic food ferments are indeed anaerobic processes, whether we're talking about alcohol production or lactic acid production. Those don't require oxygen. But there are also lots of foods and beverages. Think kombucha, vinegar, tempeh, which require oxygen. So they are aerobic. So a biologist might say those are not strictly speaking fermentations, but in the, you know, lay world, you know, of foods and beverages, everybody considers these to be products of fermentation as well. So I work with a broader definition that fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. When we move into the realm of compost and thinking about compost, people have very passionate feelings. You know, you have to build an aerobic pile that will generate a certain amount of heat. You know, some other methods work with anaerobic organisms and conditions. So I am continuing to apply my broad definition that fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms, which can, you know, cover, you know, any kind of compost pile.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit more about this concept of soil fertility and compost. I mean, to many, you know, there you mentioned that there's kind of passionate advocates for different types of compost management, and you know, on a really basic level, you know, you have everything from just throwing kind of stuff in a pile in your backyard to a more kind of intensive input output kind of turning measurement of carbon and nitrate system. So kind of across the spectrum, I mean, how would you, like, what would your approach be, or where do you see kind of people using different types of compost techniques for different end results?
Well, I mean, I would say for the most part, for, you know, large farms that have machinery that can easily turn a huge mass, you know, I think aerobic composting methods are, you know, extremely efficient and elegant and wonderful. You know, but if you don't have, you know, a tractor with a front loader that makes it really easy to repeatedly turn a pile when you need to turn it, you know, I've had fine results in my own, you know, backyard with, you know, really low involvement compost piles where, you know, I just try, I dump my kitchen waste, I dump my garden waste, and then I try to use some, you know, drier, browner, carbonaceous material between each of those layers, you know, and maybe I'll turn it once over the course of the season. And that's a pretty mixed bag what's going to develop in a system like that. You know, I know one of the issues with big compost piles, if you, you know, construct them well, is they build up a lot of heat. And so when the activity gets that frenzied, then the organisms are metabolizing so fast that they often run out of oxygen. They don't have enough oxygen in the center to sustain that level of activity. And that's when a pile goes anaerobic. And that's why gauging the temperature is a great way of knowing when you really need to be turning the pile. I'm really not particularly, you know, an advocate of any specific system or other. You know, in this section of the book, you know, I'm mostly just trying to relate the fermentation concepts that the, you know, previous 13 chapters focus on, which have to do with food production, and point out the fact that we use a lot of the same concepts, you know, in agriculture and in other non-food applications of fermentation.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that I think people kind of think about a lot when they think about fermentation is you know, issues with regards to safety. Like, how do I know this is, like, a safe thing to eat? And with regards to compost, I mean, I think earlier this year out at Freshkills landfill, they had actually a compost fire. So, I mean, what would have gone wrong in that instance that would lead to that kind of outcome?
Well, I mean, I'm guessing that the heat at the center of a pile just got so intense that it was able to, you know, catch some of the dry carbonaceous materials on fire. This is the first I've heard of it. I've actually never heard of such a thing before. But you cannot underestimate the, you know, potential power of these processes, especially, you know, in something like composting. You know, the bigger the scale, the greater the opportunity for accumulating heat. And you know, I mean, I've seen you know, steam rising out of you know, a relatively small compost pile that was, you know, 6 feet high. I can only imagine when you mass garbage at the kind of scale that exists at Freshkills, what the potential for heat accumulation might be.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, everything ended up okay over in Fresh Kills, but I think it was kind of an interesting story that came across my desk. Well,
let me address the bigger safety issue that you raised, because I think, you know, especially for, you know, people of our time who are raised and indoctrinated, you know, into what I call the war on bacteria, and this idea that, you know, this generalized idea that bacteria are dangerous, our lives would somehow be better if we could eradicate all the bacteria. And so, you know, when people, you know, set up a jar filled with vegetables at home specifically in order to cultivate bacteria, they bring a certain amount of fear to it. And a lot of people are concerned, you know, how do I know that I'm going to get the right bacteria growing and not some invisible killer? You know, how can I be sure that I'm not going to make my family sick or one of my friends? And, you know, at least in the realm of fermenting raw vegetables, you know, this process is intrinsically safe. As a matter of fact, according to the USDA, there never has been a single case of food poisoning reported in the United States from fermented vegetables.
Wow.
And there are not many foods that you could say that about. You couldn't say that about raw vegetables, because we hear every year about you know, people getting sick from you know, lettuce, spinach, tomatoes. You know, it's been sort of, you know, one raw vegetable after another. But you know, if you were to take vegetables that had been subjected to some sort of incidental contamination like that, and set up the conditions for a sauerkraut fermentation, what would happen is that the lactic acid bacteria that are always you know, part of the you know, indigenous microflora on any raw plant material, they will dominate the environment, and as they acidify the environment, they will destroy whatever the, you know, contaminating pathogenic bacteria are. One of the really beautiful and elegant things about lactic acid fermentations is that they are a built-in you know, safety mechanism. They create a condition that does not allow any of the organisms that we know the names of, that we regard as pathogenic, that can make us sick, they don't allow them to grow. So that's what makes sauerkraut and related vegetable ferments such intrinsically safe foods.
Yeah, and I get the sense that there is kind of, you know, a growing interest in fermentation. I know here in Brooklyn, you see kind of a lot of new kind of smaller scale food businesses popping up, taking advantage of some of this interest. But on a broader scale, you know, I'm just thinking of like Jamie Lee Curtis and the probiotic yogurt commercials. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on kind of the co-opting of that language, or, you know, using this kind of microbial or anti, you know, language as like a sales tool for a company like, you know, Yoplait or Danon. And like, is that a real thing? Is that something worth paying extra for? Is it something that is in yogurt already? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, you know, I would say all yogurt is probiotic. You know, just because yogurt is defined by a bacterial community, and there are always lactic acid bacteria in yogurt. People define probiotics in different ways. You know, some people, and I would imagine that the probiotic yogurt manufacturers are among them, would say that, you know, probiotics are only specific strains that have been studied and proven to have benefit. The World Health Organization works with a broader definition and just says that probiotics are any bacteria that confer benefit to the individual who ingests them. And that individual, you know, could be a person, or actually could be livestock as well. Most of the research is done on proprietary strains of bacteria, typically bacteria that are of human origin. So, you know, so bacteria that are derived from somebody's intestines have been isolated in the laboratory and propagated and studied. traditional foods are not owned by anyone, and you know, there's nobody to sponsor clinical trials of sauerkraut, for instance. But there is a limited amount, and so most of the research about probiotics is about specific proprietary strains, but there has been a little bit of really fascinating research looking at, you know, people who eat traditional fermented live culture foods. The one that stands out in my mind the most was a study in Spain where they took a group of people who eat at least 5 portions a week of, you know, traditional live culture fermented foods. They did some baseline analysis of the subject's blood and stool, and they got baseline numbers on some indicators of immune functioning. And then they put those people on a deprivation diet, and after a few weeks of deprivation, everybody's indicators had been severely suppressed. So that suggests right off the bat that, you know, there is some immune-stimulating benefit to these traditional fermented foods. Then they put half the group on traditional yogurt and the other half of the group on one of these probiotic yogurts. Both of those groups restored approximately equal function, but none of them restored the full function that the people on a diet of varied live culture foods had. So in other words, the greatest immune-stimulating benefit that we get is from the variety of bacteria, eating bacteria associated with different types of fermented foods. You know, because of the flexibility of bacterial genetics, a single strain will never be as powerfully beneficial to us as eating a variety of different kinds of foods that have their own indigenous bacterial populations. So, you know, I have become a strong, you know, believer in the probiotic benefit of, you know, traditional fermented foods. You do not need to have, you know, specific strains which have been studied. You know, although, you know, the studies are very impressive, you know, all of the varied things that have been demonstrated to show improvement on the basis of probiotic therapy.
That's fascinating, and it's kind of no surprise that variety leads to greater health outcomes. I think you'd probably see that across all aspects of someone's diet. We need to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about fermenting urine, an unexpected component of this chapter.
Okay, well, we can talk about that.
All right, we'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Okay, we're back. You're tuned into the Farm Report, and we are talking fermentation. So I want to get into this idea of fermenting urine, but maybe before that, you can comment a little bit on this idea of waste, both I think human and animal, as a kind of disposal problem versus a nutrient kind of opportunity, and how maybe those two arguments go back and forth or change when you look at the scale of agriculture from a backyard garden to, you know, a large scale, you know, cornfield.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that The way we have structured our society, we call our excrement waste, and we actually pollute a lot of water, carrying it away, and then in every town and big city, we need plants to then clean it up. So we create a waste problem. And then the way most people are fertilizing their fields for growing crops is to use chemicals, synthetic fertilizers. And I merely point out that in natural systems, waste is not an inevitability. What we are conceptualizing as our waste that needs disposal, we could easily reconceptualize as a resource that we could use as part of our strategies for fertilizing the soil.
So this idea of fermenting urine, it's something I feel like my grandpa did. I have like these memories of him like out on the field talking about giving his plants a golden shower, but I never really connected the two. So what exactly is that process and why would we do it?
Well, I mean, urine is very rich in nitrogen, and it can be a great resource for fertilizing soil. Fermenting urine, actually, it turns out that we have an old word in the English language, because aged urine, fermented urine, which is, it's an ammonia fermentation. It becomes more alkaline as it sits. People have historically used fermented urine as a cleaning product in their homes, sort of in place of what most people would use something like ammonia for today. And the word in the English language for that is lant. Now, as a fertilizer, it's my impression that urine, can work well fresh or can work well aged. As a practical matter, the way that I have had to collect urine results in some of it being aged, because if you collect it in a container, then what first goes into the container begins to ferment and further alkalinize while you're continuing to add fresh urine to it. I think it can be profitably applied to fields and to crops, generally diluted with more water, either in its fresh form or in its more aged fermented form. But in my desire to survey different applications of fermentation, I thought it was important to include that.
Wow, you heard it here on the Farm Report. Urine as a house cleaner or fertilizer for your backyard garden. So start saving the pots, I guess. One of the other aspects in the agriculture chapter that you touch on that I would love to hear more about is preserving forage for livestock, looking at silage and kind of how we feed, I think, the majority of dairy animals in this country. And maybe you can talk a little bit about why it is that this is kind of one of the main food sources for these animals.
Well, I mean, silage is almost exactly like sauerkraut. You pile up your raw plant material, you pack it really tightly, and it undergoes a fermentation during which it, is pre-digested to some degree, making it easier for the animals to digest it. And the acids that are preserved help to, the acids that are produced help to preserve the plant material, which is exactly what is happening in the case of sauerkraut. So, really silage, is, almost exactly the same thing as sauerkraut, except usually instead of doing it in a vessel, you're mounding it up or inside of a silo, although there are historical examples of doing silage in pits or trenches as well.
And what would be like the raw ingredients of silage for those who might not be aware?
Well, I think it could be lots of things, but it typically would be hay, but it could be lots of other kinds of things. Basically, you know, anything that the animals might be willing to eat, you know, when in its raw condition, they also would be able to eat, preserved silage.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense if you think about, in particular, the Northeast, kind of the growing seasons are not year-round, and there is this real need to essentially put up a food supply for your animals, regardless of whether they're raised in confinement or they're raised on pasture. There's not a lot of pasture in northern New York in, you know, January, February, March. So this gives people an opportunity
in any temperate zone, whether it's bales or silage, but yeah, some winter forage is absolutely essential. And for on many farms, you know, silage is just a more practical of storing it.
I want to move, back in terms of your book, but kind of forward in the world of agriculture. You know, chapter 13, you talk about, fermentation and local food and commercial enterprises, basically giving some really great advice for how to scale up a fermentation business. And maybe you could go over some of the considerations for someone who might be interested in getting into their own, sauerkraut business. What would be some of kind of the things that they should be thinking about?
Well, first of all, I would just point out more broadly that, around the world, throughout history, farmers have had to figure out strategies for turning the raw products of agriculture into more stable forms, which are also typically more valuable forms. And so, thinking about the expression value-added products, ferments are, many of the, sort of most ancient and well-established value-added products that a farm could create. So, for instance, if you grow grapes, if you can turn those grapes into wine, you have something that is much more valuable and much more stable. If you are producing milk and you can turn that milk into cheddar cheese, you have something that's much more valuable and much more stable. If you can turn cabbages into sauerkraut, same thing. You have something that's more valuable and more stable. I need to be completely honest and say that, I have never run a food production business, but what I have done is, met and interrogated all sorts of people who, turned their interest in fermentation, which they honed in their home kitchens, into a small business. In some cases, tiny enterprises that are, just supplementing someone's income, and in some cases it's, one person's full-time job, and in some cases, employing a number of people. So this can be done at all scales. I think that, really practicing what you're doing at a small scale before you start to scale up, doing it through a year, through seasons, so you can learn something about how to maintain product consistencies through fluctuating temperatures and such. I think that the best favor that anybody, thinking about starting an enterprise like this can do for themselves is to, find some other people who have started similar kinds of businesses. If people right in your neck of the woods seem reluctant to share in starting a similar kind of a business that they might perceive as a competitor, well then, find someone in another part of the country who, isn't going to have to be concerned about that. But, I think that the best and easiest lessons to be learned are lessons that you can learn from people who have already attempted successfully to begin a business like this rather than, inventing the wheel at every turn.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm just curious, in your experience, how forgiving is the fermentation process in that the quality of the product that you're putting into it impacts the kind of quality of the product that will be coming out of it? And what I mean is, like, if you have a particularly, delicious and flavorful crop of something, does that lead to a more delicious and flavorful kind of final product? Or is it kind of like if you have something that's not, you know, at its peak as a fresh product, that the fermentation process can kind of take it to the next level, and kind of how do you make decisions with regards to, you know, inputs and outputs?
Well, I mean, you certainly want to use fresh and high quality inputs. But, you know, for instance, you know, I met a fellow who has an apple orchard in Wisconsin, and you know, part of what was making his orchard viable was he created a cider business as a side business. And so the, you know, the most beautiful apples that he picks off of the trees that don't have blemishes, he sells to people as apples for eating. But the apples that fall on the ground, or the apples that you know, have been bored by various kinds of worms and insects, those end up in the cider. So, you know, they're just as tasty, but they, you know, they have blemishes that would be you know, impediments to people wanting to buy them and take them home and eat them. So in a lot of ways, a fermentation business can be a nice complement you know, to, you know, other types of sales of raw fruits or vegetables, you know, because they, this often the, you know, the second quality things that are blemished in some ways, you know, can just be, you know, shredded and turned into sauerkraut or pressed into cider or whatever. But, you know, but you want to use, you know, fresh, good quality ingredients. If you, you know, if you start out with, you know, sort of, old or second rate produce, you're going to end up with, you know, second rate products at the end.
Yeah, I had always heard that with regards to, you know, making pickles, that essentially you wanted to cucumber pickles anyway, that you wanted to, the closer to the when the pickles had come off the vine that you could get, the better your kind of final product was going to be. Always led me to kind of a rush of, you know, putting a brine on to boil and then heading out to pick my pickles. In some pursuit of, like, I mean, optimal flavor.
Fresh is great. You know, I would just say that, you know, I've also seen, you know, let's say intrepid food rescuers who dive into dumpsters and, you know, pull out boxes of turnips or whatever. You know, fermentation does offer, you know, a great route to make use of an abundance of something like that. You know, while it's you know, while it's still edible, it's a great way to preserve it. So, you know, fermentation can be a way of you know, rescuing food before it rots, but you'll definitely, you know, get the best results out of things that are, you know, really fresh and wonderful.
I noticed at the very beginning of your book that you have a disclaimer, kind of including, you know, exonerating yourself and the publisher of responsibility for the consequences of the application or misapplication of any information or ideas presented herein. And I'm wondering, you know, why that was included. Was that or kind of any kind of conversation or comments you had around that?
Well, you know, I mean, I do talk about the intrinsic safety of vegetable ferments, but, you know, my book also ventures into the realm of fermenting meat and fish. And while these, you know, ferments can be done and produce extraordinary flavors and products, and which can be absolutely safe, they also can be done in ways that are not so safe. And so most of the, you know, potential risk in fermentation, you know, would be in the realm of meat and fish, I would say. And, you know, I'm trying to give people information to do it safely, but, I mean, I just want to be clear that, you know, if someone, you know, skims the section and, you know, misses an essential point and, you know, sort of misapplies the information that I gave, that, you know, there are potential consequences.
As there is with just about everything, I suppose.
A book that is, you know, attempting to, you know, empower people with skills to, you know, try all these things that, you know, many people find scary. You know, I am trying to, you know, as appropriate, you know, make people feel comfortable and remove the fear, but I also want people to, you know, I want people to be careful and to be smart. And you know, if they dig out a crock and it just smells horrible, to trust their senses. You know, don't eat it just because it's said in the book that, like, you know, that it's okay to eat. You know, if it's you be smart about it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's like one of those things where, you know, watching friends of mine who don't spend much time in the kitchen, you know, put a raw chicken on a board and then turn around and chop salad on it. And this kind of really basic need to share information that may seem obvious, I think, is important and obviously relevant. So I know for people who are interested, they can pick up your book pretty much anywhere books are sold. It's called The Art of Fermentation. You also do kind of workshops and classes. So is there a way, if people are interested in getting a more kind of one-on-one or classroom experience, that that they can get in touch with you or see a listing of your schedule? Or
yeah, sure. I have a website, which is wildfermentation.com, and you can order the book through my website. I list all my workshops. I have links to, you know, hundreds of fermentation related resources that I have come across on the World Wide Web, and absolutely, you can see my workshop schedule and try to make one of them if that is of interest to you.
Awesome. So now that you have created kind of the preeminent tome on fermentation, what's next?
Well, I'm still recovering from that. right now, I'm doing a lot of things like this, promoting my new book. And I am beginning to think a little bit about a future book project. I have a friend who is a book illustrator, and we have been having conversations about possibly collaborating on a book for children about bacteria and fermentation.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I really look forward to seeing that. And it was so nice to have you on the show today, Sandor. And I have to say, really am enjoying the book as I like plug my way chapter by chapter. Of course, I was drawn to the egg chapters first, but so much great information. I would really encourage all my listeners out there to check it out. And thanks for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Once again, you've listened to another episode of The Farm Report. Next week, we will kick off our three-part series on fiber, not the bran and raisin variety, but talking about sheeps and textile production. So tune in the next three Thursdays at 1 o'clock for everything from sheep to yarn.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.